are live. Episode 21 of To the Unknown Pod. Jim, can you believe it?
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. We never could have imagined. Guys, episode 21, a magical, very important number in the Bitcoin world. This portends great things to come. This will be great. We are here alone again, Jim. We keep having friends who fail us, you know. This is one of these things. Tim isn't feeling well today. Pray for him. Oshawa, who knows what he's doing? He's out there dancing around Portland. He could be doing any one of a number of things. We won't even venture a guess. But we are here today. We are faithful here, pronouncing and tooting our own horn of our faithfulness. Probably not the way to go. But we're just here. This is going to be an interesting episode. Let me just introduce myself for those of you who are just happening to stumble across us on Twitter. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. And today I'm joined by only Jim McAndrew. Jim, introduce yourself for the fine folks watching at home.
My name is Jim. I started a nonprofit with Tim Fox called Magnolia. We serve to orange pill the church, Jesus pill Bitcoiners, and doctrine pill everybody else. I'm currently sitting at my command center. I've been vibe coding all morning, which is anathema. If you've watched the previous episodes, it's anathema to me. I'll report back later on my findings, but so far I'm not impressed.
Jim's a backslider is what he just confessed to. He's been a vocal opponent of vibe coding, and apparently he's putting a toe into the water. But anyhow, Jim, so basically, for those of you who are just watching maybe for the first time, what are we doing here? Well, the thing is that we spend time on Twitter every week, and we could just go along and just, you know, let that time just fall off into the void, like, you know, many people do. But as Christians, we want to redeem the time. We want to basically take our time on Twitter and turn it into something that's, you know, useful, that can be a blessing, that can be helpful, and, you know, it can help people think through some of the issues that, you know, we find in some of these tweets. So that's what we do. We find tweets every week. We bring them here. And, you know, just as we're doing this, sometimes I'll see a tweet and I'll think, oh man, I got to hear Tim, you know, Tim's doctrinal take on this issue. Or I want to hear Jim, you know, what he thinks about this from like a business standpoint, from an investing standpoint. And so this is what we do. So welcome. We're glad to have you here. And so we're going to start with a little something a little spicy today. I know you guys are just not used to us doing such spicy things, but I happen to be, there's a couple tweets that are related here to this issue about, you know, what do you do? We look around and we see the financial situation of the country getting worse and worse and worse. People are in crisis in 100 different ways. And so the question is, what can you really do about this as just a normal person? Like, what do you actually do when the government's stealing from you via inflation and via just even more flagrantly, you know, through a bunch of these pork-filled bills that get passed? And then there's just 100 other ways in which our purchasing power is being stolen from us. What do you actually do? And so, listen, one of the prophets of the modern day is Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson, he's got an idea that he's been thinking up. Let's kick it over to old Tucker and see what he's thinking, and see what we think about this as Christians, as men, as Bitcoiners. Let's see here, and there it is. Here we go.
Down, or just you encourage everyone who's deep in debt to stop. And so I've often thought, if I were to retire, maybe I would start a political movement, a new party in the country, where the whole purpose is to bring the banks to their knees and shut them down, or just you encourage everyone who's deep in debt to stop payment. How about 100 million people stop paying their car loans, their mortgages, and their credit cards? In the same way that Donald Trump once said, if you take a big enough loan from the bank, it's their problem. It's their problem. You're kind of in charge of the bank at that point. I would think it'd be kind of cool to do a crush the banks political party where you just all of a sudden everyone stops payment at once. And then, you know, then you sit down with Jamie Dimon and renegotiate. Yeah. What about that? I kind of like that.
I would rather punish them incrementally and just let the demand for their horrible product dry up over time.
Yeah.
And let that be reflected a little bit at a time in their stock price instead of one morning in their stock price. One morning in the stock price, all the banks are broke. Feels a lot like 2008.
Hear a lot of downstream effects.
Pretty chaotic situation for the world.
All right, Jim. So a lot of stuff going on here. So for those of you at home who maybe aren't familiar with this bald-headed man right here, that is Dave Ramsey. Dave Ramsey, one of the most trusted economics voices in America today. He's not necessarily, you know, the biggest fan of this plan. So again, we have two sides of this plan. We have Tucker who's saying, you know, this is like smash mouth. Let's make this happen. Let's as everyone just stop paying. Dave Ramsey says, you know what? I'd rather do this more incrementally. I'd rather, you know, just stop using their product. Just stop using debt. You know, stop using credit cards. Stop going into debt to get car loans, to get all these things. Jim, what are your thoughts when you hear these? Do either of these plans sound reasonable to you? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, defaulting on your debts is pretty un-Christian. So is that to deal with? Even if the person that was lending you the money was doing something not above board in the first place, like creating the money out of thin air, you did agree to pay them back. So I think if you're, again, I'm not saying there aren't situations where Christians can't do that, but I think in a situation where you're just trying to spite the other person because you think the system's unfair, I would lean more towards Dave Ramsey's side of opting out of the system and not taking the debt. But at the same time, if you choose to live that way in our world and the way the fiat currency system is set up, you're going to lose. So we're incentivized to take on debt because, of course, when we pay that debt back, we're paying it back with dollars that are worth less. So,
yeah.
I don't know. You know, it's like you can sit there and point fingers at the bankers and say that they're the evil ones, but the person that's taking the loan is also benefiting off of it, like benefiting from it as well. The people that are not benefiting is everybody else that is not part of that transaction.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked about this before, but when you go take a loan to buy a new house, you know, I get to buy the house with dollars that were printed out of thin air by the bank. So the bank wins because they get to charge me interest on dollars that they didn't even have. I win because I get a hard asset in the house, and everybody else loses because now those dollars flow into the economy and debase the currency and reduce the purchasing power of all of their savings.
And there's one less house available than would be available otherwise. So it increases the demand, it increases the price for things like homes and cars and any one of a number of things.
Yeah. So I guess you could argue that taking as much debt as possible and buying Bitcoin with it in order to speed up the transition to the sound money standard is in some way, somehow the ethical thing to do. But I think as Dave Ramsey points out, when you try to accelerate things and make them happen too fast, it can result in a lot of pain and violence. And as Christians, we don't want to see that happen either.
Yeah, this might be worth doing a whole episode on, but going back to the very beginning of the Bible. Okay, just thinking about this as a Christian, if you go right back to the very beginning, you could honestly argue that the nature of the first sin was trying to take something sooner than it was designed to be given. Like the nature of the sin, like, and there's a lot of theologians who you know, talked about that. I think we've talked about it on the pod a little bit. You know, it's not that Adam and Eve were never going to eat this fruit. It's not, you know, when that God prohibited from them, prohibited them from eating. It's just a matter of maturity. Like he wanted to basically, you know, for them to endure temptation and then take the fruit and live forever. You know, that's you know, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. God wants, or at least one of those. God wants them. He wants us to live forever. That's kind of part of his plan. We know that because we're going to, you know, those of us who know Jesus are going to live forever with him. And so after Adam and Eve took the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, then God said, lest they reach out and take the fruit that makes them live forever in this state, I'm going to close them out from the garden. And so this is something where this is always the temptation, is to want to take something and to do whatever is necessary in order to get something now, rather than waiting and working for it, or waiting and, you know, trusting. So, you know, that is true. And in a normal, and I think it is true today. It's even more true in a situation where you do have scarce money, which is the vast majority of human history. That where it gets tricky, to your point, is like the situation that we're in right now, where for the vast majority of people, you know, it's basically not possible to get a house unless you're willing to go into debt, like significant amounts of debt. Like that's, now again, that's, even that's an exaggeration. You can get like a tax, you know, houses that have tax liens on them. Like there are ways to go about this. But it still is, you know, we've so normalized, taking on debt to produce, to purchase homes and cars and all these kind of things that, you know, that I'm very sympathetic and I think it's not as straightforward as it would be in other situations.
Also, I would just say in the context of like the Old Testament and Israel,
yeah,
there wasn't this separation of generations, right? It was your family's property. Yeah. And so there wasn't an idea of like, oh, I need to move out when I'm 18 and buy my own house. Yeah. And it was just, you're going to take over your parents' property. And if you were a woman, you were going to go live on another family's property as you got married to one of their sons. And so I think what we see with like boomers, we love to sort of hate on boomers. We love boomers. Boomers are my parents. So I love boomers. but just this general idea of boomers buying second and third and fourth homes and rental properties because, you know, again, they're victims of the same system. They know the currency is debasing. They know that rates are ever going down. And so they just have to put the dollars into a hard asset. Bitcoin didn't exist. Obviously, gold was available, but, you know, real estate generates cash flow and people kind of think that way because of Warren Buffett. And so they put their money in real estate. It bids up the prices of real estate. And then they're holding all these properties that otherwise should have, I don't want to say been transferred to the younger generation, but would have already just been inside of the family. It's not about like transferring from a boomer to a millennial. It's just, this is a family unit and it's more than just the nuclear family.
Hmm. Yeah. And that, I mean, even what you just said is so revolutionary for compared to how a lot of us are trained to think. We think like individuals rather than think like families, and we act like individuals rather than acting like families, and just not, I mean, it really is insane when you think about it. It's so foreign to how humanity is thought for the vast majority of human history. Like you can look at something like Abraham or somebody like Abraham. When we read, I remember reading Genesis 15, either 12 or 15, where Abraham, God calls Abraham to go out by himself, you know, leave everything behind, not knowing where he's going. I read that and I'm like, oh, okay. You know, like, sure. God calls him out to go, not knowing where he's going. But then I have kids. I got married and have kids and, you know, moved across the world and was a church planter, missionary. And now even years beyond that, I read that passage and I just think completely differently about it, because like so much of your family, like the life was a lot harder in many ways in that situation. And so going off on your own was like an incredible risk. Like you're safer, like, you know, you're safer when you have other people around you. You're safer in the sense of, you know, many hands making light work. You're able to have more people to till the fields, to, you know, ensure that you have food, to work in all these ways. You guys diversify labor so that you can have multiple types of things. Versus if you're just roaming around a desert by yourself, like on paper, you could argue that's a foolish thing to do. And you, again, there's a case where, you know, there could be well-meaning people who would push back on that, push back on you believing that God told you to do that, because it's like, well, God told you to be fruitful and multiply. Why would you leave your family behind? And so for them, it was so obvious that obviously you'd stay around people. Obviously you wouldn't just leave your family. Obviously you think as a family unit and not just an individual. And yet now it's kind of reversed, where because of the amount of money that we have, because the dollar, especially speaking of Americans and you know, the British before them, before us, and other places where you've got a stronger currency, the EU and, you know, whatever, like we have this level of financial independence that does shape our identity. It shapes how we think about ourselves. And so it's like, because we have this currency that gives us that affords us a level of independence and quote unquote freedom, we're just going to not question that and just continue to live like that. And really we're just kind of setting ourselves up for failure for the long term in a whole host of ways.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, back in ancient Israel, most of their wealth was tied up in their land and their camels and their livestock. Mm-hmm. And maybe they had some of it in gold or silver, but it was pretty hard to transport because it was dangerous. In the modern world, obviously, we kind of have nation states and police forces and militaries, and things are relatively safe, especially if you're just like traveling inside the United States and going across state borders. Like, you don't really have to worry about highway robbery anymore. So there's this temptation, especially with something like Bitcoin, where if you just, I mean, this is like the hodler mindset where you rent and you don't own anything and you just, you have all of your wealth stored in this perfect money that can't be stolen from you, and you can take it across borders and you don't have to worry about robbers, and you become unlanded or ungrounded at that point. You know, it almost opens up this temptation to be a perverse version of the nomad that God was calling Abraham to be. And there's sort of lots of pitfalls to living that way. I mean, I know the digital nomad kind of lifestyle is heralded as like this awesome freedom inducing thing, but I think what the digital nomad kind of nomad capitalist kind of crowd miss is that when you hop around like that, you become anonymous and there's no accountability anymore and there's no deep family ties. And like, you may have family relationships that you can keep going through technology and things like that, but people don't really know who you are and what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And you can kind of get away with a lot of things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get away with. Not that as Christians we're wanting to get away with things. We're trying to stay in community and we're trying to be held accountable. And so there's a tension there. Bitcoin definitely is a gravity towards some negative aspects of that.
Yeah, one of the things that comes to mind is that saying, all it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And there's a real sense in which, you can be tempted. And again, we love, I think there absolutely is a place. I mean, we've got like a friend of ours, Katie, you would know her, Katie the Russian. Like Katie, you know, helps people get second passports. And a lot of these people she's helping are Bitcoiners. And I think that makes sense and is wise to give yourself optionality, because again, like just given circumstances that can, you'll want to give yourself flexibility if you can get it, especially if you're doing it because of who your grandparents are. Like, that's just a wise thing to do. And at the same time, like a lot, you know, there's a downside to that too, where it's like, hey, if you know, at the first sign of trouble, you're like, all right, I'm out, you know, then that's one less strong, smart, wise, likely somebody who's well capitalized. That's one less person who's able to help, you know, keep the tipping point from being reached by some of these bad actors. And so I think that, the temptation is always to run. And there, you know, you could think about this from sin, or you could think about this from evil or whatever. We have examples. You know, we had the pilgrims, they fled, this goes deep in our American ethos. Like they fled because they were experiencing, religious persecution. And so it's easy to just, if you have the means to just, you know, think of that first and be ready to, you know, be ready just to kind of take off and want to be ready to take off with your money and start over somewhere else. There's just a number of problems that, number one, like, again, we're called not to be cowards. And so like if the only reason you're running is because you're afraid, I mean, like, there's a time to do that, I think, but there's also a time to not do that. And there's a time to stay and fight. And a lot of the people fight and you know, can be translated in a variety of senses. But like there's, in many cases, many such cases, the people who need to hear you need to stay are not the ones who want to stay. and vice versa. The ones who want to run, they actually need to hear, no, you need to not just be selfish and not just be looking for the easy thing. That shouldn't be what motivates you. Is I want ease and I don't want to potentially suffer. I don't want to do hard things. That should not be what's motivating you. So I think this is a big issue that, especially as things get more and more difficult monetarily speaking, or, you know, economically speaking, and potentially in other ways, depending on where you're living, this is something that is going to be a lot more live of an issue.
Just to circle back around to the original post and what Tucker was saying, I don't think Bitcoin actually solves this problem. I think that even if we waved a magic wand and had a sound money standard based on Bitcoin, there will still be people that have capital that are willing to loan it to people that don't at a high interest rate so that they can satisfy and gratify their desires right now.
Yep. Yeah, that's a reality. And so this is a moral problem. You know, the fact that we have usurious loans and we have 30% interest rates on credit cards and stuff like this, it's because we've tolerated it. We live in a time of like very great, you know, we pride ourselves about being so tolerant, and yet tolerance, while it can be a virtue, can also be a vice, because you see for example, in the book of, I believe it's the book of Revelation, I can't remember what chapter this is, but he's talking about like, you tolerate, it's either Jezebel or you tolerate this woman, and Jesus is basically saying, you shouldn't tolerate this person. You're acting like this isn't that big of a deal by just letting this person be there and do this. I can't remember what it is that they're doing, but like you're tolerating her, and that's actually shameful to you. And so I think that this is one of these things where, I mean, on an economic level, on a number of levels, I think the problem is we're such moral midgets. Like, we're such moral and ethical midgets when it comes to like just understanding like ethics of money production, when it comes to understanding a whole host of issues, even just historically. Historically, the Christians, Christians have seen the consequences of these things, and they follow, you know, the second and third order effects, and don't just look at the surface and be like, oh, this doesn't seem like a big deal. I think that, again, you're going to reap what we sow. We're going to reap what we sow if we just don't take the time and to learn and understand what God thinks, and just the downstream consequences, practical consequences of some of these. Things like high interest and usury and a bunch of these other things, you're gonna get what you subsidize. If you just allow it to be there, it's gonna continue to grow, and then it's gonna get worse and worse, and then it's gonna be to the point where it's too, you know, you're not gonna know really what to do about it. It's gonna be a lot harder to do something about it.
I think it's really easy to point the finger at the banker or the lender and say, oh, you're the evil one because you're charging somebody a high interest rate, but there's two sides of that transaction, and the borrower is also agreeing to pay that interest rate because they have a high time preference to get something that they shouldn't be getting otherwise. And so I think what's maybe a more interesting conundrum here is, do you put laws around that to not allow that transaction to occur, even though there's two willing parties?
Hmm. Yeah. And again, I think some of this, a lot of this comes down to, it comes down to just the structures of society, right? It comes down to there's ethical constraints that are designed to, so like if you had, I mean, you could say the same thing about like any ethical constraint. So listen, contract killing. Listen, you have two equal participants, or, you know, eager participants on either side of this. This person is willing to take money for a service. This person is willing to give them money for a service. It's like, okay, well, yeah, that's true, but there's more to it than that. And so I think like that's kind of where we got to get down to, is like, what is the actual moral implications and like ethical issues? How do we define what we're going to allow, what we're not going to allow? What's good? Like, how do we understand this? Is this just like, we're just doing this?
This is where I would push back on the caricature of Christian nationalism that I have in my mind. You know, the Christian nationalist would say, of course you should have a law against usury. And, you know, as a free market guy, I'm like, something doesn't sit right with me on that. But as a Christian, I'm like, shouldn't we just build up strong family structures and support networks and not have these arbitrary distinctions? Like, you have to move out when you're 18 and go earn everything on your own and become a self-made man. Otherwise you aren't worth anything. And like, basically we're raising whole generations of people that want to be high time preference, have no money available, get hit by advertising all the time that says they need to wear certain things or whatever. And then it's like, what do you think they're going to do? So it's like, I don't know. It seems like we should just go back to the basics and focus on the moral fabric of society and families and not try to just like put a Band-Aid on top of it, you know, that's like a law from the Christian nationalism.
Yeah. Well, and this is where this gets tricky, right? Is because you're always going to have people who are going to focus on one side or the other, right? It's like I can't remember which episode this was that we were talking about. I think it was on Tuesday. But it was this girl who's talking about how hard things are economically. And she's listing out a number of different issues. There's some that are governmental policy issues. So there's some that are, you know, just her having to work hard. like some of these things. And the reality is, yes, the problem, like the reality is that there's things on different levels that need to happen. And no one's saying that, oh, it's all government stuff or it's all moral stuff. We're saying, no, these things are both necessary. Like you need, it's like, you need a mom and a dad. You could sit here and you could point out and say, oh, look, you know, we need a mom because moms do this and this and this. And it's like, and we need a dad. And we need dads because dads do this, this, and this. It's like,
depending on who you're talking to, like the different stories play better. If you're talking to Bitcoiners, it's like, yeah, it's the money that's the problem and down with the government. And they'll be like, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
Or if you're Tucker, it's like the bankers are evil. We need to like take the bankers down, you know?
Yes. Exactly. And so that's kind of where you get it. It's like, honestly, we can have, it's just like the other day when we were talking about this girl and her issues, it's like, I can't remember multipartite. I can't remember where it was. Like you can have a war that's being fought on three fronts at the same time. Right. Yeah. Like if you're fighting in a part of a piece of land that's on the sea, okay, you can have a naval battle in front of you. You can have a land battle and you can have these other things. And you don't know, it wouldn't make any sense to go, hey, we need to focus on the land battle, you know? And you'd be like, no, yes, we do, but we also need to fight on these things. And so we don't need to just minimize the importance of fighting on these other fronts because we particularly are, you know, individually focused as far as it relates on us as an individual or something, you know, if you're the one who's sitting or you're in a boat on the ocean and you're fighting, well then, yeah, you should be focused on the ocean side of things. And if there's somebody else who's on the land, well then, yeah, they should be fighting on the land. You shouldn't be frustrated with them for focusing on the battle that's on the land. And so I think it's just figuring out, you know, where am I? You know, realistically, I only have a certain amount of hours in the day. I have certain skills, I have certain things, abilities that make me useful in one of these areas. And how can I use my voice and use my life to kind of, you know, talk about these issues in a way that will hopefully move the needle, to a real degree. But there, again, the reality is like, we can't make these things happen on our own. You know, but we should still act in a way that just takes into account that, you know, our actions do have consequences and we can, you know, we can raise issues and move the needle. Like that's totally possible.
What we're both saying is we're not advocating a anarchist, Mr. Robot style, take the system down behavior that Tucker is talking about.
But if it did happen at the same time, this is what I say is like, listen, I would understand if it did. And if it did, again, this is just one of those things where these kind of things happen. Like it's not necessarily the greatest way, you know, but again, bad things happen. Like this is the reality. Like the people, you know, barring the whole world coming to Jesus and then like coming to Jesus and basically being, all right, we're going to do this. The bankers repent. And then all of the people repent for taking out loans and, you know, like all these, barring that happening, like you're going to get some mixture of the two.
I'm just saying it doesn't take us to do it. We know the government's just going to print money and pay back their loans with worthless dollars, which is effectively the same thing as not paying back the loans. And so all we have to do is just sit here and what Tucker is saying is going to happen.
Yeah. That's a possibility. But then you get something like the French Revolution, right? You get like the French Revolution where the people literally just go take down and start cutting off heads. And again, that ends poorly. But so again, if you're looking historically,
it's interesting though. You know, the French government, the aristocrats didn't have F-35s and nukes. So it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
It's true. But all of those nukes are piloted by people who, you know, aren't necessarily aristocrats either, though. So
they've all been vibe coded.
that's true. You can do it with drones now. That's right.
The point is, as Christians, I think we should try to push for things that bring about peaceful revolutions.
Yes. All things being equal, absolutely. The reason why we came up with this Tucker tweet, the reason why we found it is because there's a guy, he's the founder of Gab. His name is Andrew Torba. He basically tweeted this yesterday, today. Can't stop thinking about Tucker's idea for millions of people to just stop paying their usury cards, he's referring to credit cards as usury cards. Love that turn of phrase. What would happen if millions of us did this? And then this other guy, I just did it. Hold on. I just went back. Let's try that. Send it. There we go. After 2008, I deliberately chose to default on all my credit cards. I was sued civilly and didn't show up, so there were default judgments. For some complicated reasons, I didn't declare bankruptcy. A couple years later, I defaulted on my house, got out of all of it, including the mortgage, just by being a 1099 contractor year after year and never answering my phone. My credit score is now 800. Credit is a sucker's game. Don't be a sucker. And so like this is, again, one of these side of things where it's just like, yeah, I mean, it's some of you probably have heard the phrase turnabout is fair play, where it's just basically like, hey, if politically you open up this door, like if you're going to go after your political opponents for something, you know, for something that's illegitimate, well, then you shouldn't be surprised that when you lose power and somebody else gets in there, that when, you know, your enemy uses these same things against you. And obviously, I'm not saying that this is some sort of, you know, panacea. I'm not saying this is a great thing that this happens, but it certainly is understandable. And so, again, if you have a government where they're literally just stealing from their citizens by creating money out of thin air, and you know, you have banks that are giving out credit cards where, you know, they're literally creating the money out of thin air. There's no actual production cost. There's no risk or very little risk on their part, and then they're just taking these fat interest payments for people who aren't able to pay because they're poor. And as a result of decades of these policies happening, it gets worse and worse and worse and harder and harder and harder. It shouldn't surprise us to see people who do the calculus and decide to go a slightly less sanctified version of the Hebrew midwives on this situation where they're just like, hey, you know, you're going to try to use us. Well, I'm going to use you, government. I'm going to use you, banks, before you can use me. And so, I think this is the kind of unfortunate situation that we're going to find ourselves in more and more. It's going to tempt people to make decisions like this one. I think
what's interesting here is that the interesting thing to me is that when you have no cash flow and you have no assets, essentially you're broke as a joke. Using credit is a sucker's game. But when you have a lot of assets and you have a lot of cash flow, not using credit is the sucker's game.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, at 7% interest mortgage rates, which are super high. Okay. Like if you just own your house outright and you can instead just go mortgage it at a 7% interest rate. I mean, there's two different things going on here, right? Like if you have to buy the house today at the current value, let's say it's like valued at $450,000 or something like that. Well, the person that owns it is probably in it at a much lower cost basis. So they don't actually have to take out as big of a loan. They could just take out a loan for like half of the value of the house.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what the value of the house actually should be at 7% interest rates, right?
Yeah.
And then that would equal like whatever the rent payment would normally be for that house. Yeah. And then just go put all the rest of the money in Bitcoin and you're making the spread between 7% and 50%. And if you don't do that, it's like you're lighting money on fire.
Yeah. And again, like this is what I'm saying is like there's a real sense in which in a vacuum, is it good to do that? Like all things being equal, probably not. But given the situation that you're in, is that a prudent thing to do? Is that like a shrewd thing to do if the alternative is, you know, like if the alternative is...
Are you saying in a vacuum, like if we were already on a Bitcoin standard, you owned your house outright, would it be a good thing to do to lever up your house in order to buy Bitcoin?
What I'm saying, yeah, if we were on a hard money standard, then yes, to do that would be a worse situation. I think that would be a lot more difficult to defend.
Only because Bitcoin's not appreciating anymore?
Yes, or something. Yeah. I guess the kind of the illustration that I would give of this is there are situations, numerous of them in scripture, where the thing that is the right thing to do under almost all circumstances, you see the people of God do exactly the opposite thing. And it's when the wicked try to weaponize the consciences and try to weaponize truth in order to for their own benefit and not for the good of people and not for the glory of God. So you have the Pharisees do this repeatedly with Jesus, is they try to trick him and trap him by getting him to, you know, by getting him to answer one of two ways. So should we, Moses tells us to stone this woman. What do you say? And so if Jesus is either going to answer, yes, I agree, stone this woman who you found in adultery, the question is, how did you find her in the middle of adultery and know to bring her here? Like, is that just perfect timing, or did you just do this because you're willing to put a woman to death in order to put Jesus to death? Is that really what's going on here? And so I think like that's the bigger issue. And that's kind of where the hesitation comes from my part. Because again, I think that it is so immoral. The system is so wrong and immoral at this point that it's like at some point resisting the system might require you to do something that wouldn't be advisable, wouldn't be wise, wouldn't be prudent in other situations. Another example would be, I don't know if you guys remember a few years ago, there's a guy named David Daladin who basically lied about being somebody who was working for, I believe, like an abortion or like some sort of medical facility that was trying to buy baby body parts from Planned Parenthood. He basically lied and said, "Hey, I work for this company. I want to buy baby body parts from you," and gets all these people, films them on tape of them saying, "Oh yeah, we rip heads off, we rip out little hearts, we rip off little feet. Oh, you know what we could do? We could actually do the abortion in such a way that we leave the brain tissue intact, because David, this guy, lied and said, hey, you know, if you can give us intact brain matter, we'll give you or intact whole head, like we can give you more money." And they're like, "Oh, done. Like we can do that super easily." And so David is lying, which the scriptures say, don't bear false witness. Like this is clearly something you shouldn't do. And yet David is lying to catch absolute barbarous monsters on tape confessing of what they're doing. So is that okay for David to lie about that? And I would say 100% and twice on Sunday. Like absolutely, yes, it's right for David to do that. And I would argue that's not even lying, because you're like, a lie, implicit in the lie, is that you're using this information to dishonor God and to harm your fellow, you know, somebody else made in the image of God. That's not what David is doing. So I don't think that's actually a lie, you know, anyhow. But again, so my point is, when you get into situations where the wicked are doing wicked things, and especially where you get to a situation where there's institutionalized wickedness, where what's wicked is actually being praised and defended and called good, well, then the righteous actually ought to be willing to. Like it's actually your willingness to do something that is looked on as wrong is actually at some points evidence that you actually fear God rather than just fearing these wicked people. And so that's kind of that's why I'm hesitant when I think about this specific issue, is because like I really do think there will come a point at which, and I don't know what that point is. This is where I get, you know, where I do think there's a point where your conscience, there is room for people to follow their consciences in doing something, not just for your own personal benefit, like this guy seems to be doing, but as like a conscience born kind of thing of what Tucker and what Andrew were talking about, where like conscience bound for the big picture sake of what's going on. I have no problem with people being willing to do this and being willing to take the consequences. Like that's the other side of this, because if you don't pay your taxes or if you do something like this, there's a good chance they can throw you in jail. You know, and so it's not
maybe I'd articulate it with a little bit of a different example. Going back to like taking a loan on a house that you own outright. If you have one person, let's say you've got two people, they both own the same house outright. One of them takes out a loan against it to buy Bitcoin, because they want to get rich quick, and the other one takes out a loan against it to buy Bitcoin because they want to bring about the peaceful revolution.
Correct.
They both have the cash flow to service the loan, so they're not doing anything crazy.
Yes.
You know, I'd argue that even though they're doing the same exact thing, it's the intention of their heart that's different, and one of them's sinning and the other one isn't.
Correct. Correct. I 100% agree. Like why you're, so your motivation isn't the only thing that matters. Like the actual outcome, like it actually does matter, but your motivation, it does matter, but it's not the only factor. And the end result is not, like, it does matter, but it's not the only factor. And so that's where, again, we want to be thoughtful because again, you see this all throughout the scriptures, the wicked weaponize truth or weaponize even like the written word. Like they weaponize, like in the case of the Pharisees, they weaponize something that God said in order to serve their own agendas and their own interests. And we see repeatedly examples of God's people not being willing to do that, not bowing the knee to these, you know, not agreeing with these guys that the world can just work this way and that God is pleased based on a rigid interpretation of a rigid wording of these things. That's just not how God actually works. And so I think that we need to be, again, it's certainly a dangerous area because then, you know, it can get you to the point where you think you're justified in, you know, doing something like murdering abortion, you know, clinics or, you know, whatever. Like there are things where, you know, it's not something to be entered into lightly. It's not something to be, and this would be another thing is, if you're trying to think through some of these things, I would involve, you know, other people, other wise people in your life, because that's another way. Again, in an abundance of counselors, there's safety. You know, if you're out there just vibe living and vibe resisting, and just trying to do this on your own, like I just think it's a dangerous path. There are resources, right? The great thing about being a Christian 2,000 years of hindsight is we can look and see Christians who've been in worse situations than we'll ever be in and how they responded in different situations. And there's people on both sides of these issues. There's people who resisted and lied and God, you know, blessed them. And then there's other people who, who suffered and God honored them and, you know, different things happened. So again, this is not designed to give a clear thing one way or the other, because that's not how wisdom works. Wisdom needs more information. It needs context, and it needs to be applied skillfully. So just something to think about there. Let's keep moving on here, Jim. This is another one. Let's see. The first two. We did the first two.
It's okay.
This won't be going on for a ton longer, but, so Darth Powell, Vlad the Inflator, love the handle, love the name here. Okay, so he shared this and this made us all rejoice. Going forward, we'll have more homes coming to market due to boomer deaths than households being formed to buy them. Yes, that is without new construction. Okay, so new household formations from 2025 to 2030, 4.3 million. Average per year, 860,000. When you get up to homes from deaths, you're talking 7.5 to 8 million per month, right? Is that what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Annual average. Yeah, yeah. So total annual average, 1.5 to 1.6 million per year. And then new homes built, you're talking 6 to 8 million. So you're going to equal homes from deaths and new homes built. That is bonkers. Absolutely insane. Jim, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, this account is a little bit spicy. He likes to use a lot of foul language. So I wouldn't say we're 100% endorsing following him, but
I didn't even know that. Does, but yeah,
he does post interesting data. He clearly has a bent. He wants to prove that real estate's going to become demonetized, which I generally agree with. I'm not sure if he's like into Bitcoin. I haven't seen him post about Bitcoin necessarily. But his big shtick is always just that there is no housing shortage. In fact, there's a glut of housing. And the only reason we feel like there's a housing shortage is because people have applied a monetary premium to real estate because they're trying to escape inflation. So I think that this is really just another side of the same coin that as Bitcoiners we already know. Yeah. In the long run, we know that real estate's going to become demonetized. And yeah, mega trends like boomers dying off are only going to accelerate that. And so at least that's my opinion. I mean, obviously, who knows what's going to happen in the future, but you know, I think what's the difficult thing is that that hasn't happened yet and we're living life right now and we need to have houses. And so the question is, what's the prudent thing to do? Like, is the prudent thing to continue renting and being a renter, or is the prudent thing to put down roots and buy a house and don't worry about what's going to happen in the future? And you know what, if you buy a house now and it's worth half what it was when you bought it 10 years from now, it's like, well, what can you do? Like, what are we trying to, the longer arc of history here, like, what are we trying to encourage people with? Are we trying to encourage people to just sell everything, including their chairs, and buy Bitcoin only? Or are we encouraging people to be good family men and provide housing for their wife and children that they feel like they can take ownership of and plant gardens and vineyards and do cool things with?
Yeah. And again, I think all of these things, whatever you're doing, it should be a means to an end. And so that's what I think. Hold on, give me 1 second here. My phone is about to die and I'm trying to plug this in. But yeah, I think that's how I just think about these things, is like, it's a means to an end. So buying Bitcoin, I don't buy Bitcoin for Bitcoin's sake. I don't just buy Bitcoin to, you know, accumulate tons of it and just be able to be super wealthy. That's not the goal. Oh, come on. The goal is to be able to do things that are actually have to do with, you know, life. Like, to, I want to have a home. I want to be able to, can you still see me, Jim?
There you go.
I want to have a home. I want to live in a home. I want to do these things. And again, being willing to be patient and wait, I think there's just wisdom in that. That's one of the hardest things to do, is to be patient and wait.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about this idea of like buying Bitcoin to not do anything with it.
Yeah.
People are doing the same thing with real estate right now. They're just 100%. Buying it to not, I mean, they'll rent it out or something maybe, but like they're really just buying it for the appreciation, AKA the inflation hedge. And so I don't know, to me, there feels like something qualitatively different between monetizing real estate versus monetizing Bitcoin, because at least when you monetize Bitcoin, you're not denying a roof over somebody's head.
Correct. And again, that's why I legitimately thank God for Bitcoin. Because, I mean, if you take Bitcoin out of the equation, this problem just gets exacerbated, right? It just gets exacerbated where it gets higher and higher. And the other outlet would be something like gold. And I think that's what you have seen happen in past, you know, empires and past points, is that you do get a remonetization of gold. And so again, it's not that it's not possible. It's not that it couldn't happen. But again, there's downsides to gold. I just think it's easier for governments to interact with gold and accumulate large amounts of gold and lock them off from people just because of the nature and the physicality of gold. The amazing thing about Bitcoin is, because it's not physical and because it's not tangible, it actually, and because it, you can interact with it on something like a phone, or a piece of technology like that, like you just give every normal person the ability to have, you know, these scarce bearer assets in a way that you can't tell that they have them. And so I'm just super grateful. Like, it just seems such like such a timely, like a timely thing for something like Bitcoin that operates under the constraints that Bitcoin does, and that has, you know, that affords people freedoms that Bitcoin does, to be to come around and be coming into its own right as, you know, this real estate thing is winding down and, you know, fiat currencies are breaking down. Like, it is, I just it's just pretty providential, incredible timing. I think of the clip from Pirates of the Caribbean where the boat is like sinking right as it comes up to the dock, and like Johnny Depp just kind of steps off the steps off the sinking boat right onto the dock, and he's just good to go. Like, that's, I think for a lot of us, the, you know, who are Bitcoiners, that's kind of how we see this. We're like, hey, man, thank God for Bitcoin. We have this thing right here when we need it most. People who don't have homes, like in a situation, I'm you know, a millennial who, you know, can't buy a home at this point, just given different constraints. But I can buy Bitcoin and have been buying Bitcoin. And, you know, all things, if nothing else changes in my life, then like Bitcoin will be the reason why I'm able to get a home. And so I just think, the other thing, the other side of this that we didn't even talk about in terms of the homes is, I mean, this is like an argument for good fiscal financial planning, because like a lot of these homes, like if you don't set up your affairs right, you know, these homes, they'll either, you know, give your kids, you know, if it's a boomer dying, give their kids like a giant tax bill, or if they're doing it, if they set it up really horribly, then like these houses can go straight to the bank. You can get hit with, you know, there can be just a number of negative consequences of these things. And so I think positioning yourself, I think it would be wise, if you're kind of on the fence, I would be praying and looking for a deal, because there's always deals to be found. That's another reality that when you're talking to Matt Purvis from one of the Island Boys, he just keeps getting presented with all these incredible deals just because of different circumstances in people's lives. And so those will always exist. And so just keeping your eyes peeled for things like that is smart. But then even if, you know, you're not in a situation where you can find one of those, or if you're still on the fence, like I think this is encouraging on some degree. I think it should be the fact that there's new surplus of inventory coming on the market, especially at a time when BlackRock and a lot of these other guys who have been, you know, helping prop up and exacerbate the real estate bubble are finding a new thing for them to buy, which is Bitcoin. And so I think that's another, you know, Bitcoin, not just for our own benefit, or not just for us being able to benefit directly from it, but also from, you know, somebody like BlackRock, which is helping to bring down and demonetize real estate even faster. I think that's another reason why I'm grateful for Bitcoin.
I agree, but I also just push back on the whole framing of this in general. Like, again, this pits the generations against each other, and it's all individualistic, and it's about... you know, boomers and millennials and houses going from one generation to the next. And it's like, these should just, all this property should just be within the family.
Yes.
And I don't even know if I agree that it should be viewed as like a inheritance. I mean, it is an inheritance at some level, yeah. But when you think about like the property just staying in the family for multiple generations,
yeah.
I think the way people think about inheritance these days is it's all about me and like what I'm getting, you know, from my parents or something, and how I'm going to spend it on a lavish lifestyle for myself. And it's like, no, like this is my family's property. I'm currently using it for a period of time. And then at which point when I die, it'll get passed on, and then so on and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like that's, you're absolutely right. Like you're absolutely right. And yet there are, I mean, like there's tons of people who, again, this is the shameful thing and the hard thing is like there's people who just have awful family situations and who, you know, who just don't have families who, you know, they don't have in some ways like the luxury of, you know, and like
I'm just like describing the ideal. I don't think there's necessarily a way to like instantaneously get back to it or something. It's gonna take like multiple generations to like heal and get back to that.
Yes, exactly. And I think what you're describing is, hey, if you're stuck in this situation and you find yourself with a horrible family situation and you're young, like you can appreciate, hey, guy, look at the downstream consequence of this. Like, you can be the catalyst for change for your family, because maybe where your family didn't think about these things, your parents, your grandparents or whatever, like, maybe, or at least probably, it's probably not your grandparents because they probably were thinking about these things. But if your parents weren't thinking about these things, hey, now you can see the consequences and you can try to position yourself and your family and whatever to be able to, you know, change that story, you know, for your own kids. And
you're going to break the cycle. You know, you're going to be the original. You're going to be the new patriarch, and it's going to start from you. You know, you're going to set the tone for 10 generations.
Yeah. And again, it's easy for us to think about that, you know, in terms of Bitcoin, but that's also true in 100 other things. There's also true, I mean, just in terms of 100 other ways that, and decisions that families have to make, you know, like you can change the trajectory of your family lineage by choosing to do different things than you know you did when you were younger, or the, you know, past generations of your families have.
All right, do we have time for one more? We need to land this thing.
Let me see here. I think we got time for one more. I mean, here we go. Let's see. This is, I guess, to that end. I mean, we could talk about. We just don't have a lot of information yet. White House confirming President Trump wants to eliminate capital gains for de minimis transactions, like $600 and under. We just have a lot of questions still about, does that mean $600 over the course of a year? Is that $600 transactions?
I feel like this is one of those things that it plays well in a soundbite, but the reality is that people are already doing this. You know, like people are already zapping sats to each other, not reporting, and the IRS isn't following up on it because they don't have the manpower. So it's just kind of like, they're just making it official what's already happening.
And even if they have the manpower, like, which they don't, it's like, what's the benefit? You're talking, oh, I'm going to go chase down a 10-cent transaction. It just doesn't make sense. It's just not worth it to do. But again, it looks cool. Again, for something like, I mean, a $600 transaction, that's like a decent sized transaction. So
I think it's a step in the right direction. Obviously, if it was the counter argument, like the government was coming out and saying, no, we're going to go after small transactions. We're coming after you, and we're going to use AI to do it because we don't have the manpower to do it. It's like, okay, that's like the alternate universe we'd be living in if Kamala had got elected and like Elizabeth Warren and her goons were hunting us down with AI.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. What's the other thing where it's like something where like the tax limit was set at a certain number, but it never got adjusted for inflation. And so it's the same super tiny number and it should be way higher. I can't think of what this is.
Probably the capital gains tax.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's like 10. What's the number on that?
I think it's like 400 something thousand. There's also a number on real estate sales. How much, if you sell your primary residence, how much of it you can take up tax free on that sale?
There's something like, I mean, something like that would actually be far more effective. Or like if you just inflation adjusted some of these really old laws, and I mean, that would be a lot more meaningful. That's probably why they won't do it. But it would have humongous effects, and be a blessing to a lot of people. But we'll finish with this one. This is another, this is on the family front, something to take with you. If you have kids or if you don't have kids and you're coming up to maybe have kids, this guy is the Warrior Poet Society is this guy's name. He has like a YouTube channel and a whole bunch of other stuff. He's a Christian guy. He used to be in the army, I think. But he had this video. This guy Antonio shared it, and it's a real.
Don't be surprised when you send your kids off to Caesar and they come back as Romans. That's it. That's it, man. You're wondering why everyone's gone woke and has no idea what bathroom to use anymore. Just if like, what happened to our kids? I'm like, well, you gave them to the government for their entire childhood. You saw them at dinner and you attended their sporting events, but the government raised your kids and social media helped and video games or whatever, but you saw them every day, but you didn't raise them. You didn't log enough hours each day to counteract all the poison and time-wasting and ideological propagandistic crap that they were getting fed year after year after year. And so millennial generation and now Gen Z has gone woke. And we feel like, oh, what happened to my daughter? We raised him better than that. No. I mean this in love, but you didn't raise him at all. that hurts to say because I know it hurts people to hear. And we trusted that they were being taught good information that wasn't undermining our values. But there's been a psyop in play for decades, which is undermining our values and waging war against the family unit. Don't be surprised.
And so, yeah, again, this like can sound extreme or whatever, but I just honestly think this is the case. Like we just on so many levels, I mean, we're just trusting that this, I mean, I know, yeah, we can speak from personal experience. Like I grew up going to public school and, you know, that's because there's a number of reasons, like economically, it would have been very difficult to go to a private school, you know, public school, both my parents went to public school and like a lot of us had parents who their experience of public school was one thing and they're expecting that the experience that we're going to have is something similar. And yet even I, like early days of the internet, you know, graduated, you know, in the early aughts, that kind of stuff. She's not going to watch this, but my mother would be absolutely mortified. I could share her 50 things that happened in my 4 years of high school alone that my mother probably would have pulled me out of the school if she had known them happening. And that's just the reality. Like you can't, it is the grace of God. Like it is the grace of God that my life looks only as horrible as it actually does, rather than, you know, far worse. Just given the reality of like what the diet was on a pretty regular basis for all of my formative years in high school and middle and high school. And so I think that just, you know, thinking carefully and thinking realistically, taking an assessment of the, you know, of the time of where you're who you're entrusting your children's minds to, and how much time you actually are having in actually forming and having good conversations with them is something that we could all use more of.
This is a really tricky one, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Because a lot of people are in a lot of different situations.
Yes. 100%.
Again, we're talking about like the ideal scenario. Tim has some family in from California and they were just saying that having three kids is like the ultimate flex because nobody has money to have three kids in California.
Yeah.
And so like the ultimate flex on top of that is homeschooling your kids.
Yes. 100%.
Because you're like, oh, I've got so much time and money that I can just, you know, the wife and the husband can theoretically both not work as much to spend the time on that. And people are in the fiat matrix rat race and you tell them this stuff and it's like, there's no hope. There's no way. Like they have, and the system is set up that way. Like Caesar is meant to be the babysitter.
Correct.
And just all this stuff we've been talking about splitting the generations apart and hyper individualism. And it's all designed. It all works together to separate us from each other, you know, and give them their tendrils into people's minds so that they can manipulate them. You know, I'm not saying there's like some evil cabal of people that like planned this all from the beginning and knew that fiat was going to make it easier. But at the end of the day, this is the emergent behavior, the emergent phenomenon that's happening with this system, with all the little individual decisions that all the administrators make and all the politicians make, because they have the lever at their disposal. They can just print the money and make the program. And I'm Michelle Obama and we're going to pay for more meals at school so that the kids can stay after school and eat dinner. And, you know, on paper, it sounds great because it's like, they're living in the inner city and it's a single mother and she can't afford to pay for dinner. And so the kid's going to get something that's maybe quasi nutritious, like as opposed to not eating at all. And so it's like, any one little thing that you look at is like altruistic, but then when you add them all together, it's sinister and disgusting.
Yeah. And that is the tricky thing, right? Is like we live in a culture, this would be a whole nother episode too, of like, we argue like from exceptions, we use exceptions to negate rules. And so like all of us, like both you and I just did this on two different subjects. It's like, this is true, but we also want to be sensitive to the fact that there's people who are in difficult situations or who, you know, it's like, correct. Like if you're in one of these situations where, you know, like this is difficult, I will say this, like the church that we go to is informally connected to a Christian school. And so basically what they've said is, hey, if you're a member of the church and you're not able to afford private school, if at all possible, we will, like, our church will help pay for you. Like, we'll either pay for it outright, or we'll help, or we'll do something like that. And so, like, if you're somebody who's listening to this, I can't imagine we have a bunch of single moms or something, like, but maybe, like, there are people who are out there who like recognize the difficulty of this, you know, in terms of like the monetary side of this, or the economic side of this, the challenges that are there. And there are lots of people who are willing to kind of do something about this. So if you're somebody who, like, you're lamenting being in a public school situation, you're like, I don't want my kids, but I don't see any other way. Again, I would just, you know, encourage just to kind of look out and go have a conversation with, you know, if there's a local, you know, classical Christian school, or, you know, if you're thinking about homeschooling. Because, I mean, just the reality is, yes, like, the reality is life is going to be hard. Like, life is hard no matter what side you come down on. And so the consequences of dealing with, like, you're either going to pay on the front end or on the back end. And so the consequences of having your kid, you know, be totally shaped from soup to nuts by, you know, especially if you're a Christian, soup to nuts by a government that hates you and, and, you know, that to completely makes fun of, you know, your beliefs and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's going to be a, I mean, you're talking the rest of your life. You're going to, I mean, the rest of your life in terms of these kids who, you know, you're going to be, who are largely, for at least a chunk of your life, largely going to be responsible for taking care of you. And so, yeah, it is just one of these things where you want to be sane. You don't want to be, you know, flipping out on people because they make a decision. And yet you also at the same time want to take account for just what's going on and how different it is than maybe it's not just a situation that your parents grew up in or that you grew up in. It's, I mean, just
there's landmines here. If you're talking to a well-meaning Christian that sends their children to Caesar and you use this terminology and they don't think of it that way, they can be highly offended.
Yep.
So I wouldn't necessarily start by saying, hey, you're sending your kids to Caesar. I think you can eventually maybe help them get there, but, like, you may not want to start there.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, you may be talking to somebody that says, yeah, I realize I'm sending them to Caesar, but what choice do I have?
Yeah.
And there needs to be a sensitivity there too, because it's the same thing when you're like, oh, you should be on Bitcoin. It's like, well, that's great, but I don't have any money. In fact, I have worse than money. I have like 30% interest that I'm paying on my credit cards.
Correct.
And so it's like, yeah, we got to get you out of debt before you have money to save that you could put in Bitcoin. So
we have to send you to Dave Ramsey first. Is that what you're saying, Jeff?
Yeah.
That's what you're...
we got to send you to Dave Ramsey just to get back to zero. Then once you're at zero, throw Dave Ramsey away and come talk
that's
to
right.
us.
Get rid of Dave Ramsey. I think that's a good place to close. Jim, grateful for you, man. Again, hopefully we'll have Ash and Tim back next week. Again, we for those of you who may be listening to this, we were able to fund the Orange Umbrella Kickstarter. We were overfunded by $2,000. So grateful for all of you who helped support that. I'm still getting updates from our artist. She's getting closer and closer, so we'll be giving updates on that and looking forward to getting that out in the world. We are grateful for you guys. Episode 21 in the books. Grateful for you. We'll see you in the next episode of the To the Unknown podcast.